Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. The Inner Game is about how we nurture and attend to our mind, body, spirit health, and how that allows us to make a bigger contribution in the area of purpose that calls to us. Because these are times that are asking us to evolve beyond the systems and paradigms that are collapsing. And these are conversations with people who are committed to making an evolutionary difference with their lives from a place of balance and love and service. My guest today is environmental writer Emma Maris. Emma was on staff at the highly respected journal Nature, and she's freelanced for National Geographic, The Atlantic, and The New York Times. She has written two popular science books, Rambunctious Garden and Wild Souls. Love both those titles. And her core interest is in human relationships with the non-human world. Emma will be speaking at the Arts Campus at Willits, what we call TACA, here on June 17th. And I'm very grateful to welcome you to The Inner Game, Emma.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. You know, I feel like my own work in community resiliency and regenerative design has become this very large inquiry. And I'd love your response to this. So the inquiry goes something like this. How do we rebuild a regenerative relationship with the natural world and function as a human species in the face of collapse of the unsustainable culture and systems we have built?
Yeah, that sounds pretty close to how I would probably encapsulate what I do. Although maybe because I've been an optimist my whole life, instead of collapse, I'd like to hope that we can gracefully hand over from one system to another.
Boy, I sure hope so too.
Without things getting really bad.
Yeah, that would be best case scenario.
Right, right.
How does your work show up in that inquiry?
Well, the focus on relationships, I think, is really speaks to me. And, you know, I've been covering ecology and conservation for 20 years as a journalist. And in the beginning of my work, a lot of it was focused around questioning the idea that humans weren't part of nature and that humans could really only cause bad things. We're always a source of trouble.
Right.
And that the best way to save nature was essentially to remove humans from it. That's what Rambunctious Garden was about, my first book, and that's what a lot of my earlier work was about. And it's been really energizing and exciting to see this idea really take off and really spread. I think that there's just a lot more welcoming of the idea that there is a role for humans in all of these interspecies relationships, that we aren't doomed to be the villain, that there are ways for us to be nurturing and sort of mutually helpful participants in these big complex ecological systems that we're a part of. So as that kind of awareness has really taken off, to my great joy, it's allowed me to start thinking about what do those new relationships look like? How do we instantiate those good relationships? And that's I think the really fun part.
Yeah, that is, you know, and that's something I've been working on for a long time, too, is like, how do we get from where we are now, which is, you know, so far away from the indigenous relationship humans had to the world for so long? And in this short blip of time, we've gotten so far away from that. How do we get ourselves back there? Any thoughts?
I mean, in some ways, You bring up the indigenous relationship with the natural world, and I think that that is, in many cases, going to be a fantastic model. I also think that that's not a static thing, that that's also has changed throughout the millennia and continues to change, right?
Right.
So I think that there's an opportunity for both learning from tradition and also for creating new and exciting relationships with the non-human world. So I think it's going to be kind of a hybrid of both. You know, for example, like there might be some traditional practices that we want to revive, but there might be some that we can't revive because maybe those species have moved because of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
But there might be some new relationships, or we might be able to enact those relationships in new places or with new partners. So I think that it's going to take not just a return to a past way of doing things, but with a lot of respect and learning from past ways, also some sort of hybrid thinking and creativity.
I agree. You know, I just finished reading The Overstory. It's about human relationships with trees and trees' relationships with each other. And it made me think about what's the catalyst for people to bridge that gap that feels like, oh, that there's a tree there. There's sort of like this thing that's, you know, maybe not even sentient, or I don't have much relationship to it. It's just a thing.
Right.
How do I get to see that as this living being that I can interact with?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I feel like, you know, a lot of it is really about the recognition of each other. Because, you know, just to sort of start at the beginning, everybody in the world, every human is right now in relationship with just like a mind-boggling number of other entities, because not only are we in relationship with the tree that we're looking at out the window or that we're, you know, leaning against, we're in relationship with a bunch of trees in, you know, Costa Rica where our coffee was grown, and a bunch of trees in Sumatra where the oil palm plantations are, you
right.
know. Through these sort of global supply chains and
yeah.
through our globalized world, we're in relationship with just a ton of other entities. It's honestly can be quite overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one way we've all sort of dealt with that, or one consequence of our relationships being geographically removed, right? Like instead of getting our food from plants that we can walk to, we now usually get our food from plants that are hundreds or even thousands of miles away, is that we have become sort of estranged from many of the other species that we share the planet with. So there is this really intense need for kind of reintroduction. And I think there's a lot of ways that that can look for different people, you know. So for some people, that might be actually, people might want to know more about where the things that they consume come from. And so, you know, there's one arm of this that's all about changing the regulations of supply chain labeling and things like that, so that people can actually kind of see the ways in which they're woven together with other species. But then for other people or in other cases, it might be making friends with that tree outside your door. And for me, that's always really, and I know not everyone agrees with this, because some people think that like sort of naming and categorizing is problematic or it's very kind of arbitrary. And I see those arguments. But for me, I've always really found a lot of pleasure in learning what species things are, and learning, oh, well, that's an oak tree and that's a maple tree, you know, just to start off at the broader family, you know, the broader level. And I've seen in other people, too, that, you know, moving from these are just green objects that are kind of like the background
mm-hmm.
to these are entities with names really changes things for people. So I'm a big proponent of, you know, learning, like everybody, I feel like everybody should know the species of every tree on their block, if they're in, no matter if they're in Manhattan or if they're in, you know, the countryside. So that's something that has always worked for me. But yeah, there's lots of different ways to get, I think, reacquainted with all of the kind of ecological partners that we're all tangled up with, whether we know it or not.
I have this beautiful tree that's been so special to me for so many years, decades now, and I call it the grandmother tree. And, you know, I wonder if you see any issue with anthropomorphizing your relationship with trees, or if that can even bring it more alive in some way. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I think if you'd asked me that question 20 years ago when I started as a very science-minded young reporter, very interested in ecology, I probably would have not liked the idea of individualizing trees and animals. I saw them as populations and, you know, sort of genetic code and much more from that perspective. But I've really changed my views on this. I feel like we have an individualization module, if you will, where we can bond with and recognize not just different species, like, oh, there's a you know, there's an arbutus, there's another arbutus. Sorry, that's what I'm looking at out the window. An arbutus. But we can also individualize, you know, that's the grandmother tree, or that's the big tree on the top of the hill, or the treaty oak, or what have you. And I think that we have that module for a reason. It helps us make sense of our world. These are landmarks and they're touchstones and resources and friends. So I'm all for that.
Yeah.
When I wrote my second book, Wild Souls, about animals, I did read a lot and think a lot about the way in which sometimes individual wild animals can become local celebrities. And that can be kind of complicated. That can be sometimes good and sometimes bad if the tension or the interaction becomes too intense.
You know, in one of your TED Talks, you say one of the very necessary things we need to do is we need to let children touch nature. And this made me think of school gardens. You know, if we need to rebuild our relationship to nature, and I think we realize that this certainly needs to start with children, then school gardens are a really vital asset. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that many of us maybe, certainly I did kind of place gardens and nature in different categories in my mind when I was growing up, because I saw nature as something that was not human and a garden is something that was. And so I really kept them mentally separate. But as the title Rambunctious Garden suggests, I've come to see that, you know, for many, many millennia, humans have influenced what we think of as quote unquote wild places, and that there are lots of ways in which humans have shaped them. So that there is a garden-like aspect to even, for example, parts of the Amazon rainforest. And on the other hand, the rambunctious part of that title talks about how even a very carefully managed garden is in some level totally beyond our control. You know, anyone who gardens knows that you cannot be completely in control of what will live and what will die and which other species will show up and how fast they'll grow and what kind of insect biodiversity might come and what the consequences of that might be.
Yeah.
So not only are school gardens a way to bring a bit of nature to our young people and to get them acquainted with a group of species, you know, they are a way to get them to touch and participate in the life cycle of these plants. And I really do think that makes a big difference for a kid, especially. You know, like an adult will go for like a 10-day hike and it just look at nature, and that will be nourishing enough, and that will be great. And if you made a kid just, you know, kids, actually little kids especially, just don't really like to just hike.
Right.
They don't want to just walk through, you know, and look. That's boring. They want to settle down in one place, you know, by a stream or in a garden where they can get their hands dirty and they can lift up rocks and they can see what's underneath stumps and all. They need to interact in
totally.
A much more tactile way.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And I love that, you know, I find gardening to be so many things, including kind of heartbreaking, because you put effort into something and then you can't control it all. You know, there's a wild freeze that comes out of nowhere, or there's some pest infestation that you just can't sort out. And it's really a dance with the natural world. And I think that's something that's really helpful for us too, like just to realize how we can't control everything.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think that in the beginning, when people started talking more about the role of humans in nature, there was a lot of hesitancy around that, because people worried that what was being advocated for was a kind of a domineering control. Like, there's going to be nothing wild left. Everything will just be managed for human purposes. And I can understand why that seemed like a really bad outcome. That would be a really bad outcome. But that really wasn't what was being proposed. You know, what was being proposed was a much more sort of collaborative, but also a negotiation, as you say. Like, we are not actually able to just dictate what a certain ecosystem is going to look like. We don't have the skills. We don't have the power. You know, what we can do is we can sort of nudge and assist, and try to, you know, if there are some species that are struggling, especially because of things that humans have caused, like climate change or species movements, then we can assist and we can aid and we can try to put our thumb on the scale. But ultimately, as you say, we are not in control of any of this.
Yeah. Well, I just want to take a quick break here just to say this is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KDNK. My guest today is environmental writer Emma Maris, and we're talking about building a deeper relationship with nature. You know, Emma, when we talked earlier, we talked a little bit about how nature can do many amazing things for us. But one of the things that I think is so important right now is that it increases our intuition or our ability to know things internally rather than through all of the external sourcing we've come to do and been enculturated to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to Ayana Young's podcast For the Wild, and she said, we've largely abandoned our faculties of intuition, which has allowed us to become desensitized to the destruction we have wrought and write it off as a cost of doing business. And I think that piece of this rebuilding our relationship with nature, while it's also something that's just innate to us that we've kind of lost a bit of, it also is putting us back in touch with our ability to know how to operate right now in concert with the natural mm-hmm. world that's a part of us. And I just wanted your thoughts on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I'm sure many of your listeners can relate to the experience of, like, checking their weather app on their phone to see what the weather is when they realize that they're 3 feet from the door and they could just go step out on the porch. I've certainly done that. And then I've thought, what the heck? You know, the world is right there for me to use my sensory perception to perceive. Mm-hmm. I don't need to see what the temperature is on my phone. So I think that we built a world of technology. So many of these technologies are, you know, we can live longer, healthier lives, vaccines, so many things that we've benefited from, but they have also, you know, kind of given us this instinct to look to technology rather than to our senses and to our gut reaction. And I feel like that has, in some ways, it's made us feel slightly disassociated from the world. It's also, I think, in some cases, and maybe in my case, sometimes it takes a toll on my sense of competence in the world. You know, if mm-hmm. I feel like I need to look up how to do everything on YouTube before I go do it, I feel like I'm not trusting my instincts, you know. Mm-hmm. And gardening is actually a place where I think that some of that can be rebuilt. You know,
totally.
When you're out there working on a very micro scale, like I think about weeding the garden and the way that you pull a weed and you know, I don't think there's any YouTube video that could quite communicate the very subtle differences in pressure that you pull on a plant at certain, you know, heights on the stem in order to get the whole root system out at once,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, this is a very kind of physical relationship with the world.
Right.
I think, you know, just in general, the more that we have some kind of relationship with our home ecosystems, the more confident we can kind of feel in our own bodies as sort of animals and as people. I think it makes us feel better.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, and there's so many studies that show, you know, that when we touch the earth and when we get our hands in the soil, there's benefits to our nervous system and to our blood pressure and our immune system. I mean, you name it. And I noticed this when I really started gardening in earnest, I think, during COVID. And
right.
I just noticed that when I went over to my community garden plot, I was immediately calm and happy. And
yeah.
That was huge.
And gardening isn't the only way in which you can have this relationship. You know, I mean, my host for the presentation is the Roaring Fork Outdoor Volunteers. And there are other organizations as well that are similar that, you know, allow people to really be part of community efforts to care for our shared land, our shared heritage, and build trails and plant things, do, you know, kind of pre-fire work. This stuff, this kind of work, I think, can be incredibly personally healing, as well as, of course, very helpful for the human and non-human community.
So much.
It's something that I've been...
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It's a win-win.
Yeah, exactly. It's a win-win. And, you know, I think in this era of AI and technology, you know, and when everyone, like the young people are always telling each other to go touch grass, you know, they know what's up. Like, that's really what we need. We need to go out and touch some plants. These kinds of volunteer stewardship organizations, I think, can, yeah, they can just help everybody all around. And I'm really hoping that we're going to see a kind of a renaissance in these organizations as places, you know, both community gardens and kind of public lands stewardship organizations as arenas for community connection going forward.
Yes. It's so vital, you know, that, and it's amazing that you can both at the same time build community with other people and with the ecosystem that you exist within.
Yeah.
And we need both so much. Something I like to ask all my guests is, what's something that you're, you know, a growth edge that you're up against in your own personal development right now? And what's something that you're doing around that?
A growth edge. So you mean something that I'm struggling to overcome, or explain that?
Could be, or something, just something even positive that you're putting some energy into that's helping you to grow and have more agency in your work, whatever it might be.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, I'll tell you that my sort of job, freelance journalism, has basically collapsed, my industry. Because for lots of different factors, journalism has really been struggling, you know, actually ever since Craigslist was invented and took away the classified ads as a source of newspaper revenue, which back in the 90s, journalism has really struggled. And then in recent years, that's really accelerated. So there's not as many places to write about the environment as a freelance journalist. Mm-hmm. And the pay to do so will no longer allow me to support my family. So that's a real change for me. You know, this is something that I've done pretty much my entire adult life. And I'm having to shift gears and realize that, you know, I'm going to have to do something else to pay the mortgage. But at the same time, I refuse to stop doing this because it's my calling. And so now I'm in kind of doing what I think so many people do, which is having to find a way to balance a life with not just work life and family / community life, but work life and family community life and avocation life. Fit it all in. So that's what I'm doing now. And that's been an interesting journey. I know many people have, I'm not the first person to try to balance all of this. But it's a shame because I think, you know, a lot of journalism these days is done by people who are doing it as an avocation, which is on the one hand sounds great, like, cause they're doing it cause they really love it. But on the other hand, it means that it's only capable, you know, the most of the journalism is being done by people who have some other source of income, whether that's a spouse, family money, and that's really limiting the pool of who can do journalism, which is bad for everybody.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, so that's something I've really struggled with the past few years. You know, seeing I'm part of an organization called the Society for Environmental Journalists, SEJ, and our annual meetings have taken on a slightly grim mood in the past few years as it's really, really gotten tough out there to do this work. And, you know, I don't want to get out the tiny violins and say, woe is me, but, you know, as people who care about the environment, it's a little scary to know that there's not much support for reporting about what's going on with public lands, with pollution, with climate change. That support is disappearing.
Yeah.
So it's nerve-wracking.
Is there a spiritual practice or a, you know, nature practice that you turn to when you need to kind of recenter amidst all of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I was dabbling in meditation And then I realized that I needed to premeditate, right? and let me explain that just briefly. If the goal of meditation is to kind of empty your mind of thoughts, I thought to myself, oh, but you know what? I'm not making space in my life to have these thoughts first. I'm so busy all day long, and I'm always have some content streaming into my eyes or streaming into my ears, or I'm listening to a podcast while I'm walking or gardening, or I'm, you know, typing an email, that I never even have time to just let my mind wander. It seems like before I can even get to the stage of being able to meditate, I need to master the stage of actually just daydreaming and letting my mind do whatever it wants. So my new spiritual practice is to go lie in the hammock and not do nothing. Beautiful. And not try to meditate.
Nice. Well, that is a beautiful place for, I think, for us to wrap up. If any of you listeners are interested in deepening your own relationship with nature, I'm hosting a retreat September 11th through the 14th here in Aspen, in the Aspen area. And you can find out more about that on my website, which is Gwen Garcelon, G-W-E-N. Garcelon is GARCELON.com. And it's just a rare opportunity to do this work of relationship building. And as we mentioned earlier, Emma will be speaking at TAKA on Wednesday, June 17th. Info on the TAKA website. You can learn more about her on her website, which is EmmaMaris, MARRIS.com. And just thanks for listening today. You can find The Inner Game on Apple Podcasts, on KDNK.org website, and on my website, GwenGarcelon.com, for all my other offerings. The music is Peter Mayer's song, Awake. And until next time, consider relating to nature as not only alive and sentient, but as a source of deep love for you.
Are swift, rocks are ancient, mountains are high.